And good afternoon. We are back on Vox Pop. I'm Bob Barrett, in for Alan Chartok today on Medical Monday. And our guest today in studio on Medical Monday is Dr. Mark Pettis, Chief of Medicine at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany. He is a Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and the former Medical Director of the Kripalu Institute for Integrated Healing, located in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Pettis is the author of two books, The Savvy Patient, The Ultimate Advocate for Quality Healthcare, and It's All in Your Head, Change Your Mind, Change Your Health. Dr. Pettis, welcome back to Vox Pop.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be with you.
We're looking for your calls today to start a conversation. It's 800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. I always see when you're here, the chief of medicine at St. Peter's Hospital, you have your arms and hands into a little bit of everything over there, don't you?
It is a busy place, and it's a position where you do lots of things, Bob. You know, hospitals these days are having to spend so much more time on systems and developing systems, so a lot of that now involves informatics and information technology. A lot of it involves continuous performance improvement and safety. So there's a skill mix now that leaders in healthcare really need to master that, 15, 20, 30 years ago were, pretty much unheard of.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking as you're saying that, how is the move towards electronic medical records going? I know there have been speed bumps.
Yeah, and there are a lot of bumps along the way. I think St. Peter's is probably not unlike many large health systems that are gradually working their way toward an electronic system. It's a major cultural change. We, for generations, have used paper records and charts, and everyone agrees that we need to be looking at more systematic availability of information so that, no matter where you're at, a physician caring for you can have access to that information. So I think it where we are at now, certainly at St. Peter's, we're in the process of what's called a computer physician order entry. So physicians soon will be ordering anything that they need, a lab test, a diagnostic, an X-ray, through the computer system. So these tend to lead to challenges just in terms of workflow, day-to-day workflow, because it is such a change. But it's necessary. We all just, accept that. Mm-hmm. And, it's a huge task, and a lot of people are involved with it.
It certainly is changing medicine, the practice, incredibly. I went to a conference in the spring, and there was a lot of talk about the medical home. And I guess the electronic records will really help that. But really, just to have one home base for your medical care, and then, you go out from there.
Right. No question. What a novel concept, to have this place where you can centralize most of your care and health needs. And I think many primary care offices are looking to develop more of this medical home model, which certainly involves embracing the electronic technology and electronic medical records, but it also involves coordination and linkage with other stakeholders of care, which might include nutrition, which might include behavioral health, which might include other specialists involved. So it really is a much more coordinated model of care that everyone agrees is necessary. It's just going to take a little while to get there.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're looking for your calls at 1-800-348-2551, and we're not here to talk about, management. We're here to answer your health questions.
Indeed.
So let's get to this. This is an interesting question. Let's go to Jonathan in Norfolk. Jonathan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Jonathan.
This question arises from my own perception of my own mortality. I'm just about to turn 65, and I am considering how I should organize what might be called my physical decommissioning. Because I don't want to leave this to my children to deal with. And one of the things I've discovered is that here in the United States, it's extremely expensive, that a very good high percentage of the medical costs which will be spent on during your life are actually spent in the last 2 years of life. Mm. And my question is, an ethical question, to what extent should that be a communal funded as compared to an individually funded event, which gets into the whole issue that we're arguing about Medicare? And secondly, as a medical professional, what do you think is a better way to think about this and indeed go about it?
Well, two challenging questions to sort of open us up, Jonathan, and they're questions that I think are very timely when you look at what is an aging population. 65, by the way, is I think you're just about reaching your prime as I look at my own age these days. But so people are living longer, and along the way are developing what are often many very complicated health issues that, as you point out, in the last few years of life. Can often involve many hospitalizations, a great deal of intervention, and often many costly interventions, which ultimately don't improve longevity, nor do they improve quality of life. And I think these are very significant ethical issues that we struggle with in the U.S. So as a nephrologist, I'm often involved with people who have advanced kidney diseases, and many are very much approaching their mortality in that context. And I find that many people spend little time thinking about that dimension of their life and how they would want it approached, and often have not had that conversation with loved ones, may not have a healthcare proxy. And at times of crisis, particularly if an individual is not able to adequately speak to their needs and their values, many of those decisions are, if you will, left to chance or left to best guess, and don't always represent what an individual would want. So these are very significant issues, and I don't know how else we can begin to get our arms around it in the U.S. other than to try to create as much dialogue as we can. These are not easy discussions often for physicians to have with their patients, and they're certainly not often easy discussions for people to just bring up or to think about, and often leave it to the system to sort of decide what best to be done. And that certainly is not the best option for most people. And when I look at attempts to legislate, for example, Medicare reimbursement for physicians to have end-of-life discussions that on a political platform end up framed as death squads. You realize just how far apart we are, I think, in America of really transparently and honestly sort of engaging the magnitude of this issue. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, Jonathan, but I
have a suggestion.
Yeah, please.
Which is that under Medicare, each individual has to make these end-of-life decisions, which could then have dollar amounts put against them. And in order to participate in Medicare, a certain amount is available to do certain things. And thereafter, you agree and there must be a funding source.
Yes.
For whatever else needs to happen, because otherwise it becomes an impossible, open-ended commitment of the community and essentially our children's generation.
Right.
To fund.
Right.
And I think that poses, I think, a very important intergenerational ethical issue.
Yeah. And I agree with you, Jonathan. And I think with all of the discussion now and the political elections around healthcare reform, cost, Medicare, I really do think that the elephant in the room is the recognition that we can't afford to sustain the trajectory that we're on. And a great deal of resources are spent providing care that really does not add greatly to an individual's life and certainly doesn't add greatly to their quality of life. And it's hard for me to imagine America perhaps assuming a kind of model that you see in the UK or perhaps in other countries where more explicit limits may be placed on the need to be making those decisions and how many resources can be extended when those circumstances come up. I'd love to see that dialogue. I think what you're suggesting makes sense. I'm not sure how quickly we'll get to that debate here in the U.S., but it's one that we need to be thinking about and discussing.
Do you think doctors professionally should take a position on this? Because after all, they are involved at every step of this and know more about it technically than anybody else.
Yes.
But I have not seen the American doctors, senior doctors such as yourself, as a group, taking explicit positions. I wonder why not.
Yeah, and I think physicians struggle with that. Now, I work with physicians day to day who, and these are physicians that usually specialize in critical care and intensive care, and they are frequently trying to drive these conversations in a very proactive way, and they do tremendous work in their capacity to recognize where resources are being applied. So a lot of that does happen behind closed doors in discussions with families and in specific clinical settings. But as a collective, this has been a difficult voice for physicians to embrace. And I think in America, we struggle with a mindset. Many of us are deeply enculturated around the notion of promoting life and promoting life as the mandate. And I think physicians often, while they may have strong opinions about what's appropriate or not, are not always comfortable with what to share and how much to share when they're dealing with patients. That's not universal. As I said, I see many exceptions to that. But it's been very hard for us as an organized profession to come up with a unified sort of stance and recommendation. There's starting to be inklings of that. The American College of Physicians and other professional groups with respect to palliative care, I think, are beginning to make their way into mainstream thinking. And all of that very much addresses the central issues that you raise.
Jonathan, thank you for your
call.
Thank you
very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. We'll take a quick break and be back with more of your calls.
Support for WAMC comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years experience. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. And Maria College, Albany, offering RN baccalaureate completion program, associate degrees, and professional certificate programs. Day, evening, weekend, and online classes. MariaCollege.edu.
And we are back on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. Our guest this afternoon on Medical Monday is Dr. Mark Pettis, Chief of Medicine at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany. We're taking your calls again at 1-800-348-2551. Whatever topic you want, we'll give it a shot. Let's go to Gail in Albany. Gail, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Gail.
Hi, Dr. Pettis. I would like to hear your thoughts regarding the Affordable Care Act seeming movement toward preventive care and how important preventive care is in our whole struggle to reduce health care costs.
Yeah, that's really a great question, Gail. I think the Affordable Care Act and so much of the current attempts to reform health care are requiring a fundamental redesign of where we focus our resources. And as you point out, so much of the expenditures in healthcare are focused on either managing diseases once they evolve and exist, or applying very advanced interventions for advanced disease complications in order to prevent further complications. So we have a system that spends a great deal of time, energy, and resource on more downstream manifestations of disease. So it clearly, in my view, and I think that of many, prevention is where we need to be focusing more of our time and attention. It is easier for me, just to give you an example, Gail, at times as a physician, to get an insurance company to consider reimbursement for a very significant intervention like a heart angioplasty, balloon angioplasty, than it would be for me to get that same insurer to pay for a nutritional consult. Our models of care, as you and everyone well knows, are designed around the 7-minute visit. There's virtually no time to educate. There's virtually no time to try to assess an individual's readiness for behavioral change. And we know that most diseases have a lifestyle behavioral component to them. As many as 70% of visits to healthcare providers are on the basis of some issue that has as its root a lifestyle behavioral origin. And yet ours is a system that both in terms of how physicians are educated, as well as how our systems are designed and financed, is not at all aligned with the priority of addressing prevention. And I think the medical home model, these accountability care organizations that you hear and read about, I think are an attempt, at least conceptually, to begin to get healthcare providers to shift away from doing lots of things and focusing more on preventing these things from happening and aligning reimbursement more along those lines. Right now, and this is just the elephant in the room, most healthcare professionals are incentivized to do lots of things. So the more tests you do, the more visits you have, the more interventions, that revenue will follow. There's very, very little revenue attached to spending a lot of time educating an individual, to helping a person understand risk and benefit and to make those more thoughtful, well-informed decisions. So we have a lot of work to do. I think we are at a crisis in terms of healthcare in this country. Certainly, we can't sustain the trajectory that we're on. I'm glad that this debate is coming more into the spotlight, but we've got a lot of work to do, and I couldn't agree more with your sort of assessment in terms of prevention and where it needs to be.
Gail, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gail.
1-800-348-2551. One, interesting you say that, because there's a commentator on the health show. Mm. She has been doing commentary about her weight loss for about 3 years now. She lost 100 pounds
wow.
on her own.
Yeah.
She did a great job, and she commented throughout the entire process. And the one that got me was when she talked about how her insurance company would not pay for her nutritionist visit, but would have paid for bypass surgery.
Yes. Yeah.
But she ended up doing it without the surgery and, well, on her own dime, too.
Yeah. So. Remarkable, isn't it, Bob?
It is.
I mean, that speaks to the fundamental disconnect that we have in terms of where we emphasize our resources in terms of financing and where they actually need to be. It's a huge disconnect.
1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Rita in Amherst. Rita, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Hi, Rita.
Hi. Thank you, Doctor. I'm calling. I have a very good friend who has chronic lymphatic leukemia. I had never heard of this before, and I'm trying to do support for him.
Mm.
And I just wondered if you knew anything, in any place to... I mean, he is seeing an oncologist. I believe the oncologist is a good doctor, but I still don't grasp the whole thing too much myself, and I know he doesn't.
Mm.
And also, so I just wondered if you had any resource place to go to, with understanding it better, but also if there are any, you know, alternative therapies in terms of lifestyle or diet or whatever, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it. While chronic lymphocytic leukemia would not fall into my sweet spot from a knowledge strength perspective,
uh-huh.
Rita, I think in terms of just general principles as they relate to navigating what can be a challenging health issue, certainly medical oncologists will offer a standard array of evidence-based treatments, which usually will take the form of chemotherapy. And I suppose in some instances they might include consideration of a bone marrow transplant. Again, I'm not expert with respect to CLL specifically. But I think outside of obviously that very important dimension of care, there are many aspects of self-care that we know can influence how well a person does when they're confronting any problem, including, in this case, a what we call a hematologic or a blood malignancy. And often those aspects of care have a lot to do with reducing inflammation. And inflammation is simply a sort of an overexuberance of our immune system. And there are many things one can do through healthy nutrition, through mindfulness-based stress reduction to try to help navigate with a bit more calm and equanimity with respect to movement. And perhaps in some instances with respect to certain supplementation that will reduce the burden of inflammation, will help improve nutritional status, and to a large extent, I think, can help people navigate the traditional treatments of their cancers. So a lot of the emphasis that I look at in the integrative health or holistic literature looks at what is referred to, this is a good Scrabble word, the oncometabolic status, which really refers to just the status of an individual in terms of how friendly it is to cancer cells. And people who have a lot of inflammation, people who don't eat well, people who don't exercise much, and certainly people who confront a great deal of stress in their lives tend to create more favorable environments for cancer cells to grow and reproduce. So much of the focus is on trying to tailor those lifestyle and behaviors. Maybe a little bit of vitamin D. There may be some other supplements that can help individuals. And finding that kind of physician to partner with is sometimes easier said than done. But there are several people in the Capital District that do provide very good quality care to complement that which your friend would be receiving from a medical oncologist. And if you wanted to get my working email from the folks here at WAMC, they can pass that along, and I'd be glad to give you that information offline.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you,
Rita.
You're welcome.
1-800-348-2551. How often do we hear the word inflammation when talking about healthcare now? It just seems to be right there at the root of all the real bad things.
Yeah, really, it really has become the bullseye on the target of public health, Bob. And inflammation, you know, as defined by immune systems that are now very hypervigilant. You know, in modern society, our immune systems are being provoked in ways that they've never been provoked before. And that provocation occurs from seemingly trivial things like gluten, for example, for some people, or stress load, or sleep deprivation, which is very, very common. And so we're now seeing inflammation as a fault line that leads to most chronic complex diseases. And it really is a very hot and interesting topic.
1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Doug in Woodstock. Doug, good afternoon.
Good morning, Dr. Pettis.
Hi, Doug.
I had a recent experience with my brother who was on vacation who had a kidney stone. And I drove out there, and my experience was that I recently retired as a paramedic, and he was in the emergency room and had been there for a couple hours and was absolutely miserable, doubled over in pain. Mm. And I found both that this was a smaller ER, the ER physician and the nurse who was taking care of him basically were kind of spouting off pain management thought processes that were like 20 years old. And I had to make a huge stink to basically get him comfortable and, again, on the inpatient floor. So I guess my question is, in your practice, and nowadays I know the Joint Commission on Accreditation takes it more seriously, but what can a patient or family do if they're faced with this to try to, one, either get appropriate pain management, and two, if there's a ER or a practicing physician where this is an ongoing program, try to get them up to speed on current practices?
Yeah, good question, Doug. You know, pain management has become a very controversial area, and often these controversies emerge in emergency department settings. And I say controversy in that, on one hand, we know there are a lot of people with very legitimate health issues, and a kidney stone is as legitimate as you can get. And anyone who's ever had pain from a kidney stone, it's just excruciating, unforgiving
right.
pain. And priority number one should always be to immediately or as soon as possible to bring that pain under reasonable control. And there are many ways to do that pharmacologically in emergency room settings. The challenge is there are instances where we know many people are now coming to emergency departments complaining of severe pain, and kidney stones are not an uncommon scenario, where they may be looking for pain medications and they have another agenda, and I've seen people who. And I just to share, you know, they'll go into the bathroom as they provide their urine. They cut their finger a little bit. You know, they add a little blood to the urine,
So the urine has blood in it when it is measured, and everything is perfectly consistent with a kidney stone, and, you know, 3 or 4 doses of Demerol or morphine or Dilaudid later, you know, nothing comes up. They leave the emergency department with instructions only to show up someplace else. So I think one of the challenges that this has created is many physicians, though you should always start by believing, obviously, what it is you're hearing, sometimes pain is met with a bit more skepticism and scrutiny than what might need to be the case. You know, the treatment of kidney stones is not rocket science, and any board-certified emergency department physician will see a lot of it and should know how to manage it. But pain is an important quality issue, and emergency departments, like all other parts of hospital care, should be tracking patient satisfaction, and pain control has become a major quality and safety issue that the Joint Commission and the Center for Medicare Services is now looking at very closely. So emergency departments need feedback after an encounter if an individual has not had their comfort adequately met or if there have been unnecessary delays, and they need to learn from that feedback. Most places have processes in mind to improve performance, but there is, I think, a bit more scrutiny, and it's well-intentioned, that sometimes creates unnecessary delays.
Right. I appreciate it very much, Doctor.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Doug. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to go to Andrew. Andrew, good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hey, Andrew.
My time between Montreal and here just across the border, which is only an hour away, and I've called into the show and brought the subject up before. Canada, being only a couple hundred miles away from Albany, why haven't any of the shows, the radio shows, I listen to a lot of them, pretty addicted. Why hasn't anybody ventured up to Montreal or Ottawa or Toronto or British Columbia and just talk to anybody in the street and see how wonderful the health care is? And I know that Alan Shartok, who I've spoken to before on the radio, agrees.
Yeah.
I can't believe no one's picked up the ball and just gone up to Montreal or Ottawa. They're English speaking. It's only a couple, 3 hours away.
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, Andrew. There's certainly, though I don't know how readily available it is to the average person, but there certainly is a whole lot of data that has looked at both public satisfaction as well as physician satisfaction in systems like Canada that have, you know, a single-payer model. And you know, just for the record, Andrew, I've long been a proponent of a single-payer system, what some people are now referring to as Medicare for All. And sometimes I'm stunned when I see or hear just how many people respond to that notion. Ours is a culture that still seems very resistant, except perhaps in states like New York and Massachusetts, where I'm from originally, that I think can appreciate.
Vermont is leaning towards it, but they're having struggles.
Yeah, but it's hard for me to imagine how we can ever in the U.S. get our arms around reducing cost without somehow streamlining the way we provide care. And, you know, a great deal of every dollar spent on healthcare goes to insurers, goes to administrators, and we just have a very inefficient and bloated system. And at the same time, while we spend twice as much per capita as most other countries in the world, including Canada, our healthcare outcomes really don't stack up as well as many countries. When you look at mortality, when you look at teenage pregnancy, and we continue to have, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, but probably over 40 million or so Americans that are still uninsured. And I've yet to hear, you know, a lot of fundamental discussion in the current debate as how best to address that. You know, you raise a really interesting issue. There's a grassroots movement amongst the physicians across the U.S. It's, you know, Physicians for a National Health Program. I'm a member of that group. And there are many, many physicians that I think are becoming more vocal in their advocacy for that. But you don't have to look far to see a model of care, while not perfect, is able, I think, to provide reasonable care for all of its citizens at a much reduced cost compared to what we confront here in the U.S.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate your call.
I just wonder if the doctor has ever spoken to doctors or patients from Canada that are visiting in the States.
Hmm. I do. I've been privy to those conversations. I do hear and observe them at times, but I think they still tend to be somewhat selective.
Thank you much. 1-800-348-2551. That's the number to call. We will be back with more of your calls right after this.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center Poughkeepsie, offering a graduate program in social work and graduate and undergraduate programs in nursing. Adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. The Blue Bonnet Diner, Northampton, since 1950, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner, banquet facilities, seating 150, banquet menus, bar services, and dance floor, bluebonnetdiner.net. And Reform Pilates Studio, Saratoga Springs, teaching Romana's Pilates, providing a fully equipped studio with Gratz apparatus, private, semi-private, and small group classes. ReformYourBody.com.
And we are back on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. I'm Bob Barrett in for Alan Chartok on Medical Monday. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Pettis, Chief of Medicine at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany. And we've been talking a lot about reform and medical records. Haven't been talking much about medicine. So let's get let's get into some symptoms here. Let's talk to Harriet in Woodstock. Harriet, good afternoon.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Harriet.
It's a complicated thing, but... Very basically, I'm wondering what the symptoms of a hiatal hernia would be, or some kind of hernia located high up in the body rather than down around the groin or anything, and how that could that affect heartbeat and breathing issues, where one that's sort of the question.
Yeah. So hiatal hernias, and just for other listeners, you know, a hiatal hernia is a weakening of the diaphragm where the esophagus passes south, if you will, and right at the diaphragm, the esophagus usually connects to the stomach. So the stomach is below the diaphragm, the esophagus sits above it. And when that opening becomes more relaxed, part of the stomach will migrate northward above the diaphragm. And that's what a hiatal hernia is. Now, so most hiatal hernias actually are asymptomatic. Most people who have them don't know they have them. And often they're just picked up by chance. You have an X-ray for some reason and they just happen to see it. And it's, you know, what we call true and unrelated. But symptoms from a hiatal hernia can certainly occur, particularly if it's a larger hiatal hernia. So if more of that stomach is migrating northward, one could, in addition to things like reflux and heartburn, could certainly be getting a bit more of a mechanical effect as again, you're sort of pushing against the lungs. So you may be filling more easily. You may have more bloating. It may be a little bit harder to take a deep breath.
Yeah.
You know, is there a typical connection between a hiatal hernia and a heart rate? You know, not typically, but on occasion a hiatal hernia might be so large that you do put a little bit of pressure on the heart. And that might cause the heart rate to slow down a little bit because of what we call the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve runs right along the esophagus into the stomach. So a large hernia might stimulate the vagus nerve, which could slow the heart. But my guess is that's probably an unusual manifestation.
Could it make like a flip-flop kind of palpitation sort of response?
You know, possibly, you know, if it were high enough up and large enough, you know, things sort of rolling around and churning there could certainly create that sensation.
I had occasionally had a very interesting sort of where I can't, I can breathe, but I don't feel that I can fill my lungs. So it's like the air gets stuck in the top half. That's what the sensation. But I can't draw in a breath that fills the lungs.
Yes.
And then, but I find if I bend over, I can. And that's interesting. And the other day I had that, I had the whole day I felt like, oh, you know, this is annoying, but I couldn't really fill my lungs. And then I sat down and I had dinner, and the whole thing just, there were a few like movements of funny kind of gurgling stuff in my stomach. And all of a sudden, the whole thing was just gone, the breathing thing.
Mm.
So it's just a very interesting thing that I'm trying to follow up on and find out about. And another quick question would be, how's a triglyceride count of 63?
A triglyceride count of 63 is a triglyceride count that I would like to have. That's a terrific count, Harriet. You know, we consider normal less than 150. Ideal is really less than 100. So if you're living in the 60s, you are in a very, very good place.
Okay. Harriet, thank you for your call. We appreciate
it. Thanks. Okay.
1-800-348-2551. Jim is in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. How are you doing?
Good, Jim.
Good afternoon, doctor. I was listening in the program earlier. We were talking about making reference to the fact that excessive inflammation is an underlying factor, can be in many chronic conditions.
Yes.
And all. I've been trying to even out my blood chemistry, so I'm on the alkaline scale, and I have been successful more recently because I've been taking powdered kelp every day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helped me get my acidity level back over, my blood chemistry over from the acidic side back over to the alkaline side.
Yeah,
thing is, our bodies are microcosms of the macrocosm we live on, the globe.
No question.
Our bloodstream should be alkaline, like the oceans to cover the globe.
Yes.
And it was due to taking powdered kelp that was able to get that back there quite readily, actually. I was trying to do it with calcium supplements and other things, but this came and brought it right over there.
Okay, Jim, is that it? You got a question?
No, that's it.
Okay, well, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks, right. Jim. And I will just say quickly in response that, if you look at the standard American diet, which for many people involves lots of processed foods, lots of what we call very high glycemic foods, foods that have
the producing white flour, white sugar.
Exactly. Foods that have a higher, and certainly red meats and animal proteins are much more acidic. And so people do tend to consume much more acidic foods than what our bodies were designed to be in relationship with. So I applaud you for sort of making
another
that
thing
connection.
Another thing that helped a lot is I got a hold of a book a cousin gave me to my birthday back in 1996. A book called Fit for Life. It does nothing with exercise. It's how you eat your foods. And it recommends not eating highly concentrated animal proteins with highly concentrated plant carbohydrates in the same meals together.
Yeah,
okay.
Separating your proteins and your carbohydrates as much as you can.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks for your call, Jim.
All righty.
1-800-348-2551. Richard is in Queensbury. Richard, good afternoon.
Yes. With all the concern about high medical costs, medical care these days here, I'm wondering how much of it would be attributable to these very high-priced end-of-life treatments that, saving somebody that's close to death.
Yeah, this is sort of pertinent to an earlier call, it contributes to a fair amount of it. I think most people, statistically, from Medicare data, most people spend the majority of their healthcare costs in that last year or so of life, and often in the last few weeks of life. And as I had alluded to earlier, we spent over $2 trillion in healthcare last year. And again, well more than two times per capita what other countries in the industrial world spend. And yet our healthcare outcomes are not often what one would expect. And people are often surprised by that because they assume that the American healthcare system is the best in the world. And there are a lot of things that we do extraordinarily well, don't get me wrong. But as a system of promoting health, in my humble objective opinion, we fall short in many ways. And a lot of it does involve the resources that we expend toward the end of life. And I think there's a tremendous need to be introducing, long before people become acutely ill or more desperately ill, notions of advanced directives, healthcare proxy, and for people who are confronting healthcare problems that are known to progress over time, whether that be Alzheimer's or heart disease, palliative care is a very important dimension of care, which is really beginning to make its way into mainstream medical thinking. And palliative care really tries to help people focus on their comfort, on control of their symptoms. It's not to replace traditional care, but the emphasis is a recognition that there are some disease processes over which we really can't do much, and our focus really should be on helping people to have the best quality of life that they can have with whatever time they have remaining. That is a mindset that still has not woven its way into the fabric of traditional medical care here. It's changing. And I think you're going to be seeing and reading a lot more about that. But I think it's a big deal and very important.
Richard, thanks. We have a lot of calls here,
okay.
Richard. Thank you for your call.
Thanks, Richard.
All right. Let's go to Andre in Westbrookville. Good afternoon.
Hello, this is Andre.
Andre.
My question is kind of unique, I guess. PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, wounded veterans, and surgeries. What I'm trying to say is that before I go in for an operation, my anxiety level goes through the ceiling, and I start to have flashbacks, et cetera, et cetera. Not non-violent, don't misunderstand me.
Yes.
And I try to talk to the doctors, the nurses, and I get the hospital protocols that are all thrown at me, that we can't sedate you, we can't do this, we can't do that until after you're hooked up to all these monitors and all this stuff. How do I get around this to get a better communication level with everybody?
Thank you for the question, Andre. And the scenario you describe is not as uncommon as some listeners might think. There are a lot of people out there for various reasons that deal with post-traumatic stress issues. And I've worked a lot with Vietnam veterans and veterans from the Middle East. And there are many other sources of trauma in people's lives that can significantly provoke what I would refer to as a fight-flight response. You know, the same sort of fight-flight response that you might see in Southeast Asia reproduces itself in a very different context, like waiting, anticipating surgery. The most effective integrative models attempt to provide and empower people with more effective self-regulation skills. And these are often types of meditation or mindfulness-based stress reduction skills that can help people in anticipation of provocation of their PTSD symptoms, help them with skills that can not necessarily eliminate the symptoms, but can often bring much greater control to them.
You're absolutely right, Doctor. I am on an antidepressant, and I'm seen by a medical physician who specializes in veterans. And up until the moment I step into that the holding area, I'm just fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's once I'm in that clinical setting,
right,
that I can't get them to sedate.
Yes. Yes, and well-intentioned as they may be, there are reasons, as I'm sure you've been told, why giving sedation at a specific time may carry some risk. Obviously, symptom control is important, and sometimes you need sedation to achieve that. There are a lot of great resources. You know, one of the sponsors of the show, the American Meditation Institute, here in the Capital District, does a lot of work with people and very terrific work around stress reduction. And these are often techniques that you can employ anywhere that in that moment, as you sit in that MRI machine or you're waiting to go down to the OR, these are breathing techniques, guided imagery techniques that are really powerful and can help mitigate the magnitude of those responses when they occur and might leave you a little more resilient without medication or perhaps without as much medication. So I definitely empathize with what you describe and would encourage you to maybe explore what resources are out there to help with some of these, we call them mindfulness-based stress reduction skills. And the AMI Institute is a really good place that, that may offer some help to you.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I know you have a lot of callers.
You're welcome, Andre.
Thank you, Andre. Appreciate the call. Thank you for everything. Let's go to Jan in North Adams. Jan, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Jan.
Hello. I want to talk about palliative care. I was in the emergency room a few months ago, and I had severe pain, abdominal pain. And but I use pain management skills. I meditate. I use visualization and breathing technique.
Mm.
And they basically treated me like I was a hypochondriac looking for attention.
Mm.
The condition got worse, and I went to another emergency room. They found the problem, and they treated it. So my point is that it goes both ways. Even if you do know how to handle pain, they get the wrong impression quite often, I'm told.
Yes.
I at least experienced it myself.
Yes. Yeah, so thank you, Jan, just for sharing your story, because I think it speaks to, again, ours is a culture, and we've had kind of a thread woven through many of the questions and comments. You know, ours is a culture that has not yet opened itself to many of these alternative ways of symptom management, of stress reduction. And sometimes there's a tendency for people who do employ them and employ them regularly and effectively, and I applaud you for doing that, there can be a perception at times on behalf of healthcare professionals that, you know, folks that do that are a little bit out there.
Yes.
I think that pendulum is rapidly swinging, and it's a shame that whatever may have obscured the capacity to find the diagnosis originally, that did not happen. But, you know, I think so much of the work that you and I and so many of us have to do is to educate each other with respect to just how powerful and important these techniques are. And ultimately, this is what we're designed for. You know, what has always amazed me about us as human beings is we are beautifully designed to heal ourselves. And part of the problem is we live at a time where there are many obstacles that interfere with the capacity for that for that potential to become unleashed. And it's even more challenging in traditional health settings when people are dealing with acute problems. So we've got a lot of work to do. I'm glad you called, and I thank you for that.
Okay, Jan.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. All right, let's go to Jim in Malta. Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, Jim.
I hope I have time to go over this.
Only have a couple of minutes, so
okay.
Start talking.
I have an unresolved issue, I guess, for me. 3 years ago on a strenuous hike, I had what they called a mini stroke, and I spent the night in the hospital. Had a whole series of tests, and they said they couldn't find any real cause for it, but all the symptoms had disappeared, so they assumed it was a mini stroke and put me on full dose aspirin. And my family physician was never positive it really was the TAA. They always thought it might be something else, but couldn't decide what it was. Recently, I just had my annual exam, and he picked up a irregular heartbeat. So he gave me an EKG, sent me to see a heart specialist, and he told me, well, that's nothing unusual for someone over 68 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But my doctor, family doctor, thinks that somehow could be related to what appeared to be a mini stroke.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of, I still hike, I still run, but I have this feeling like there's a hidden time bomb someplace.
Mm. Well, to the extent that your movement, walking, running, may be threatened by the perceptual landscape you've got right now, I would try not to let that happen, Jim. Whether you had a mini stroke or not, I don't know. Just with what little information we have to share in the short time that we have to share it, what I will say is that mini strokes are very uncommon if a person doesn't have other risk factors, such as smoking, such as high blood pressure, such as diabetes, or a very strong family history. And there are other things that could certainly mimic a mini stroke on an entirely different basis, from, you know, migraine, you know, to, you know, low blood sugar. An irregular heartbeat is most important if that irregular heartbeat is what we call atrial fibrillation. And that.
Call it POV?
PACs are premature atrial contractions.
Right.
I suspect that's what you're referring to. And that does not carry a stroke risk like atrial fibrillation would carry. So that irregularity doesn't represent a threat from what you describe. So I would say from what little you've shared that your risk of having a stroke is probably negligibly small. And, you know, the value of an aspirin may be a little bit hard to assess from a risk-benefit perspective. Obviously, if this was a stroke, it's not a bad idea. If it wasn't, it's probably not giving you any added benefits. So, but thank you for the call.
All right.
And sorry, but we got to go. Dr. Pettis, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
A quick hour.
Yeah.
All right. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. Thanks again for joining us on Vox Pop. Our engineer's been Zach Malloy. Your call's answered by Tiffany Brown Bennett. The producer is Patrick Donges. In for Alan Chartok, I'm Bob Barrett. Stay tuned for the news.